Well, welcome everybody. We're going to be discussing Rhea versus Jamie Thomas, and I'm Brant Howell, and I'll get into a little bit of that in a second. And with me, I've got Ed Johnson. Ed's an artist management guy, and I'm an entertainment attorney. And I guess we'll just kind of jump on into it. Well, first I have some pre-prepared remarks, and then Ed and I will be kind of having some discussion afterwards. Like I said, we'll jump on into this. The reason why this particular case is important is this is the first file sharer lawsuit to actually go to trial. There have been a lot of other lawsuits that Rhea filed, but most of them settled for reasons we'll kind of get into later. Another reason why this one has drawn a lot of attention is the $1.92 million judgment, which is a little ridiculous in my opinion, but again, we'll get into that a little bit later. First off, about me. Who is this guy and why am I wearing a suit? You know, I figure I've seen Sith Lords and vampires and all sorts of silliness running around. I figured I'd go straight to the top of the evil scale and dress up like a lawyer. I'm an entertainment attorney. I also do IP work. I do manage everything from licensing. I have a couple of record companies I represent, do all their copyright work. I also represent several inventors, some small businesses, some actual individual artists that do music, actually some artists that do graphic work. So just a little mix of everything. I work for Fresco & Courtney. It's a law firm in Jackson, Mississippi, and we do almost exclusively entertainment law. And just incidentally, this is my favorite Munchkin card. I figured it was appropriate. Some very good advice there. Don't get in a fight with a lawyer. He will take 90% of your assets. Not good. So just to get a little background about this case before we kind of get into the specifics, I want to know why Rhea is so concerned about file sharing. First off is, legitimately, Rhea does have an interest in making money. And putting music together is expensive. You got to pay your artists, because usually these guys are broke. They aren't going to do anything until you pay them something. So you have your artist advances, recording costs can run high. You got to advertise your album, make copies of your album. So if you're not making money on this album, it's not worth it to do business. Also, another reason why Rhea is concerned is album sales have been dropping since 2000. I've got a slide next that kind of shows the decline. And Rhea is kind of concerned, all the record companies are concerned, even the smaller ones I represent. There's been a shift in the business model, and everyone's just trying to figure out how to deal with the new ways consumers are buying music. And a lot of the independent retailers have gone out of business. Now, basically, if you want a CD, you're going to have to go to a big box store, a Walmart, or a Best Buy. So things are changing. And here's an example. This was taken from Wall Street Journal. The sales, as you can see, kind of peaked in 2000, and they have gone steadily down into 2008, where there were an average of 800 million albums sold back in 2000. Now we're down to about 500 million. So there's a reason for concern from the business level. A little background on what Rhea is. Rhea stands for Recording Industry Association of America. Rhea was actually founded in 1952, and they were there to enforce technical standards, which is something I really didn't know until I started researching this particular topic. They actually do a lot of stuff other than this. When you hear about an album going gold or platinum or whatever, they're the ones that are doing that. Giving those awards out. Also, they lobby Congress a lot, and what they're more commonly known for, at least now, is their intellectual property enforcement. So let's go do a little bit of history on how we got here. But let's go back to the 80s. You know, you got big hair, pop music, and more importantly, cassette tapes. Now, pre-cassette tapes, and well, actually, cassette tapes were available in the 70s, but they really got popular in the 80s. Pre-cassette tapes, there weren't any good ways to make copies of music. So before then, the record companies really didn't have anything to worry about. You can't go make a copy of an LP. But at this point, you started having people pirating music in their homes, passing to friends, whatever. Not a big deal, but it still was something that Rhea was a little concerned with. And, you know, cassettes are great. Of course, you know, again, they're not real concerned because you play them, you run down the road, you stick them on your desktop, they turn into a pile of molten slag and you can never use them again. But anyway, kind of moving forward in time, Rhea lobbies Congress, gets the Home Audio Recording Act passed in 1992. Of course, law always follows, never leads. Cassettes were already kind of on their way out before this even hit. But the AARC, or Alliance of Artists and Recording Companies, was created to handle the Home Audio Recording Act stuff. Basically, what they did is every time you buy a copy, a CD, or actually in this case a cassette, or a cassette recorder, anything that has a record button, there is a tax put on that. And that tax is taken and handed back to the record company, since they just assume you're going to be pirating this stuff, whether it's actually happening or not. But that's what the government decided after RIAA lobbied them. So all these artists and record companies get royalties off that, and that made them happy. Okay. And later, this was extended to cover CDs in addition to just cassettes. Of course, that was, again, I think that was in the 2000s, so law is following, not leading. They're way behind the curve.
A mere 20 years after the introduction of the CD.
Absolutely. Also, kind of going back, we have the MP3 standard created in Japan in 1991. And this didn't get a lot of press initially because nobody had the megs you needed to hold an MP3 on your computer. But as technology has gotten better, MP3's made more sense, the compression has gotten better. Winamp was released in 97, which really started the MP3s being used as a medium. The first MP3 player was sold in 98, and at that point, RIAA started getting concerned. They sued Diamond Multimedia over their RIAA player because they weren't getting those ARC royalties that they were so worried about. And that suit was dismissed, never went anywhere. So that was when they started really kicking up their enforcement. They lobbied Congress, got the Digital Millennium Copyright Act passed in 98, and this was really designed to handle digital downloads, because before, record companies weren't even thinking about digital. Everything was a physical copy of a CD, physical music. But once this was passed, it was kind of moving in that direction. Also, the Digital Theft Deterrence of Copyright Damages Improvement Act. It's a mouthful. Congress's fault, not mine. I'm sorry. That was passed in 99. And again, we see we're kind of moving toward this case. Then Napster hits. Sean Fanning created Napster in 99. Now, just as a little background on me, I was in high school at the time. I was in one of those dorky, nerdy schools where you got to go through a huge application process to get in, and they give you a pair of Coke bottle glasses and a kick me sign when you walk through the door. So I was surrounded by a bunch of nerdy guys on a campus with, it was a boarding school, so we're all in dorms, we've got high-speed internet connections, and there was a lot of downloading going on. And I can say now, statute of limitations, no prosecuting me. Like I said, lots of downloading going on, lots of music passing around. I know at least at our campus and in college later, it was cramming the, causing problems with the server, internet connections, but you know, growing pains. But anyway, you got Sean Fanning here with Napster. He was a college freshman at the time, incidentally, so did pretty well for himself. He got sued by Metallica and Dr. Dre, and they settled that, then RIAA jumped on him, and that was kind of it. They lost the case. The court in that case basically said that places like Napster, your file sharing groups, they're required to control what content is on there and have a mechanism for taking off anything that's infringing. And Napster couldn't do that, so they went bankrupt in 01. So then RIAA kind of goes on the offensive. They sue Aimster, they sue Grogster, LimeWire, everybody they could find to sue, they were doing it, just kind of going whack-a-mole, just hitting everything they could find. But it really wasn't getting them anywhere. So RIAA goes to the dark side. They start suing their actual file sharers, and including little girls. And they got a lot of bad PR on that, and I'm sure most of you are aware of that, and probably the reason why a lot of you are here. So this is how a RIAA lawsuit works. They get on LimeWire, or whoever it is they're researching. They find somebody who's sharing files, and they start gathering evidence. They take screenshots of what they've got up there, anything they might need to worry about. And then they go through and they obtain the IP address from that particular site, and then use it to contact the internet service provider, figure out who this person is. Then they find that person's name and address, and they go actually file suit. And they just did massive lawsuits, everybody they could find a name to. And then once they file them, then they contact this person, and their general model was offering to settle the case for $750 per song that person had shared. Which, of course, if you've got thousands of songs shared, that can be ridiculous. But anyway, a lot of those settled because people just don't like to be sued. I don't like to be sued.
I'm sorry, clarification for you.
Sure.
Is that every song that is available for sharing on that person's computer, or every song they downloaded?
It would be for sharing, because that's the way they were figuring out who is sharing. They really didn't have any way of figuring out who's downloading. So they were just, if you're sharing music, they say, okay, you're file sharing, you've got our stuff. And actually, they probably went through and culled it down to, we represent these record companies, so these are the ones we're going to sue on. Because obviously, if I create something, put it up there to share, they can't sue on behalf of me because they don't represent me. But that's kind of the way they were running these lawsuits. And the downside with doing it this way, because they really don't know who they're suing before they do it. You've got lawsuits being filed against children as young as 12, people who are just computer illiterate, have no idea what they're doing, people without computers at all, and people that were dead at the time. So they're just, they really don't know what they're doing. They send it all out there and just throw it at the wall, see what sticks. And just kind of fast forwarding ahead to kind of after the case we're about to discuss, RIAA has announced they're no longer filing suits against people who are downloading. They've said that they are going to continue with the suits they currently have in process. Now, I've seen some anecdotal evidence that they still filed some more, so I don't know if that's accurate, but that's at least what RIAA's press release said. Now, the way they plan on doing this in the future, and we can discuss this kind of in the panel, is they are planning on getting together with internet service providers and trying to get them to agree to put in a three strikes rule. If they catch you downloading three times, they'll shut off your internet access. That's what they want to do, as opposed to this lawsuit method. And the reasons for changing strategy here is, running all these lawsuits is expensive. Because a lot of these suits, they're settling for smaller amounts, at least if you look at it from RIAA's standpoint, they're small amounts. They're not small amounts for the people who are paying. But lawyers can get real expensive, especially when you're hiring a lot of lawyers for a long period of time like they've been doing. Also, we've gotten some very, very bad PR. Most people, I mean, RIAA is a curse word in a lot of places. So, and they understand this. Also, it's been fairly ineffective. From what I've seen, the projected number of people downloading, of course, is kind of hard to define that. But that number has really stayed constant. I mean, there have been a lot of people to move to legal downloads, like downloading from Apple and so on and so forth. But like I said, the illegals has probably stayed about the same.
It's up, actually.
Oh, is it up?
Yeah.
Okay. So obviously, it's not doing a whole lot of good.
Yeah.
But which is why they're trying different tactics. And again, they're kind of panicking. Their whole industry is going down. There's a kind of a shift. How much of that has to do with illegal downloading, and how much of that has to do with just consumers are purchasing music differently is very much up for debate. I kind of think it has more to do with just a changing environment they've got to learn to deal with. But as far as this case in particular, I want to talk a little bit about Jamie Thomas Rassett. She was married during the course of this pending lawsuit. Because this lawsuit took, I think it was originally filed in 05, and it took until June, and it's still running. It's a long period of time. A little bit about her. She was is a single mother. I've seen anything from her having two kids to four. I guess it just depends on when in time an article was written. She's a Native American. She works on a reservation. She makes $36,000 a year. And when at the end of the second trial, she was hit for a $1.92 million judgment. And that's one issue I see with this, is there's no way this woman is ever going to pay anything even close to this number. So the number's really more of an academic point. It makes for good press, but realistically, RIAA's not going to see a lot out of this. Now, RIAA looked up, doing their standard investigation method, found her file sharing in February of 2005. They saw her sharing over 1,702 songs. I think that was a number they put in their pleadings. They only actually sued on 24 of them. Now, there can be some legitimate reasons from their standpoint to only choose 24. Could be their copyrights weren't in order. Could be that they didn't represent all of them, so on and so forth. But that the suit was only over 24 tracks, so about two CDs worth. And the reason for that 1.92 million figure has to do with the damage statute, 17 U.S.C. 92504 for anyone who's concerned and wants to look it up, and probably won't. basically, under that statute, if you're suing for copyright infringement, you can sue for profits or you can sue for statutory damages. Now, part of the issue with why I think this case kind of went off in the left field, this statute is really designed more for one record company stealing music from one record company. And it makes sense because in a case like that, okay, I stole one track off your album and dropped it on my album and did it. Then it would make sense to hit them for a larger judgment. For someone sharing, it doesn't make nearly as much sense. Also, the profits doesn't even fit in this scenario. So, because in this case, the file sharers are not making money off this. So profits is out the window. You've got statutory damages, which regular infringement, that ranges anywhere from $750 to $30,000. That's where they were getting that $750 per track for their settlements. That was what they were basing it off of. They were assuming that was the minimum they could make at trial. Willful infringement, which is basically instead of I was infringing, it was I went out of my way and I was doing nasty things, and that's almost rising to a what would be a criminal level, but it's not criminal, but it's some kind of, you know, very negative state of mind. That's $750 to $150,000 per track. So these can mount up very quickly, as happened in her case. The first trial went in October 2007. Again, it's a long process because they found her file sharing in 05. So a little over 2 years later, she goes to trial. Jury was out for 5 minutes, came back with a $222,000 judgment. Now, part of the background for this was that the judge ruled that making files available in and of itself is proof of infringement. Now, I don't know that I agree with that, but that was one of the issues, and that's actually one of the issues that's still not settled. And my personal beef with that particular statement is that to violate someone's copyright, or to infringe it, you have to violate their exclusive rights, one of them being their right to reproduce in this case. My question is, if I take a CD, leave it outside of my house, that and someone may or may not have come and copied it, is that enough to say that that was an infringement? I don't think it is, but the court in this case, in first trial, said, yeah, it's enough if you prove that it's up there, that's infringement. Now, there was some case law that kind of happened, was going on in the background at the time, and that had to do with that point. The judge decided that that was unfair jury instruction, decided to retry the case. So, case two, the judge basically left a lot of that issue up to the jury and just didn't fool with it. And we'll hear later on how that's going to happen. I don't know yet. Jamie got a new attorney. Her previous attorney, I'm assuming she was paying for, and I'm assuming, again, this is just from what I've been able to uncover, being that she was making $36,000 a year, I doubt she was funded real well. Her new attorney was pro bono. But he took her on trying to fight this case. The second trial occurred in June of 2009. This time, at least, the jury took a while. It took them 5 hours. They came back with a verdict of willful infringement, which I don't know that I agree with that it was willful, but that's what they found. So they figured $80,000 per track, 24 tracks, $1.92 million. Now, this case is a likely pending appeal. I, again, saw a news article that said that she was going to appeal it. It's since this case came down in June, I don't have the ability to go and check and see if an appeal has actually been filed, but it may have. So practical considerations in this. One, as I mentioned earlier, there's no way Jamie Thomas is paying this. I mean, she may have a big fund in a bank somewhere with $1.92 million that says jackpot. I doubt it. I wish I had one of those. I don't. Also, there are jurisdictional issues. This woman's living on an Indian reservation. To what extent can the federal government enforce a judgment, allow someone to go onto the reservation and take property? And that's really a question of Indian law. I don't know, but I think that would be a problem. The other issue is that willful standard that I was mentioning earlier, those are punitive. The idea is to punish. If someone's doing bad, you punish them so they don't do it again. And punitive damages are supposed to be tailored to the extent necessary to deter any further negative conduct. And this is clearly excessive, which is part of the reason why I don't think that the judgment is going to hold up, at least in the amount. If Jamie Thomas was my client, I'd probably just tell her to go bankrupt and don't worry about it anymore, because what else can RIA do? So that is a very strong possibility. So Rhea's not really going to make any money off this. What they want is that last line. They want to show, want the courts to say that making music available is enough to constitute infringement. And that's what they're currently pushing for and what they'll probably be pushing for at the Court of Appeals level.
Did the judge instruct the jury that that was the case?
The first time the judge instructed the jury, that was the case.
So isn't that already the case?
That, basically, one lawyer looked at some appeals decisions and said, this is the case, and managed to convince the judge. Then the judge ruled on it. Then another lawyer came back later and said, no, here's some other case law that we found since then. Please reconsider. The judge reconsidered and said, okay, we're just going to let the jury sort this out. Yes, sir?
Don't all crimes in court torts have a component that the person has to intend to do this thing? And if they don't really understand what the software is doing, you know, their iTunes lets other people in their network play their songs or all these other things, wouldn't that cause a problem for this?
I agree with you. I honestly think that most everything should have an intent element. Unfortunately, that's not true. Copyright infringement, trademark infringement, all of your intellectual property infringements, those are called strict liability. If it happens, you're guilty. It doesn't matter if you meant to do it or not. Other places where that's used is companies that do oil spills. Anything that, you know, even if you didn't mean to do it, you're doing something dangerous and you should know. That's usually where strict liability comes into play. It also comes into play in this arena. Also, as far as crimes, there are a lot of federal crimes that don't have any kind of an intent element. If you do it, you're considered guilty. Child pornography is an example. There's also, in fact, I read an article a while back. There's been kind of an explosion of those recently of federal crimes with no intent elements, which I have an issue with personally. But that they are out there, and if you know if you have a problem with that, that's a lobby with Congress issue. But anyway, kind of getting back to this, that's kind of what's going on in the background. So I guess my suggestion to anybody in here is, first off, don't download illegally. I mean, because these artists have to make money. You know, if they can't make money, they won't make any more music. But if you are going to download it illegally, don't file share, because that's how they catch you. And if you get contacted by Rhea, settle quickly. You don't want to be sued. I can open it up for any other questions anybody has, and then if you want to add some stuff.
Well, I mean, because a lot of stuff you talked about kind of pertains into what I was going to talk about. I'm more on the side of the artist. I work for a company called A&R Unlimited, which is an independent artist consulting firm. I'm also a band manager. A couple of the bands that we represent for Extreme Management is the death metal band Suffocation and Origin. And what we've come across from the independent and mid-level band, not Metallica, but the mid-level artist, is that file sharing, even the independent artist would still consider it stealing their music, in that, you know, they're doing something, and we just accept it as a part of life. When Suffocation just released a new album, Blood Oath, it was out a month early, and people were file sharing it, and it's just a cost of doing business, and it still got to 135 on Billboard, so they weren't too upset. But what you were saying about the record labels and how they're panicking, I kind of like to bring up the fact that they were given an out in 2001 after the Napster settlement. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals of California told Napster, you know, F you, you're done. And Napster went to the record labels with a $1 billion deal. They offered them $150 million a year for 5 years, independent labels another $50 million for 5 years, to license non-exclusively all of their music and create a paid service. The record labels said, no, we want CDs. Because at that point, CDs were at $19 a unit, despite the cost of CD production going down. With CDs, record labels are more able to hide money from the artists. We were just talking about this before. There is clauses in recording contracts for breakages, for returns, for all these things that you can't do with the electronic distribution.
Quick question. Wasn't there a class action suit, something about that, where they had overcharged for CDs?
There was a government inquiry about that in the late 90s, and basically they said,
never
yeah.
Went anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, the cost of CDs did go down from that.
It was something along the lines of, like, if you would basically, this class action suit stated that if you would purchase the CD between 2000,
you got some money back.
98 to 2000, and I actually signed up and I think a year and a half later, I got a check in the mail for like $25 or something. But I was just trying to remember, like, what was that, like, a general consensus that they had been overcharging for?
Yeah, the cost of producing CDs decreased. The physical cost of CD production, you can go to disc makers or whatever and get 1,000 CDs for $1 a unit. So when, and he's right, there is a lot of cost involved. You know, the songwriters and everything, and what he actually didn't mention, which it makes it even worse for the labels, is that 75% of new signings to any major record label doesn't make any money. And 10% actually make enough to recoup their money, so the artist makes money. So basically those few Britney Spears, Metallica people is funding the whole freaking label. So when they start feeling that they're losing money, they're gonna panic. So there is some legitimacy in that. There are a lot of expenses, but $19 a unit is just, it's price gouging, and that's what pretty much that class action was about.
As I recall, that one of the benefits that they used to sell the whole idea of CD technology is that CDs are cheaper than cassettes. So
and
when they came out, right, and they last a lot longer. And yet, when they came out for $15 or $17, and they only went up from there, and cassettes were still $10. And people were buying them, think they were coming, you know, not only were they going to come down in the future because they're just cheaper, but, I mean, they're cheaper than cassettes were.
Right.
So
record labels had no invested interest in getting away from CDs for the reasons that I mentioned, because the only... There's really no way for a recording artist to know how many CDs are being sold. SoundScan is not perfect. The only way an artist can know how many CDs are actually being sold is if they audit their own label, which usually means they're not going to get renewed and no other record label is going to touch them. So you basically just have to take their word for it. You sold 50,000 CDs, but we're on Billboard. You sold 50,000 CDs, here's your, and that's it. That's all they can do.
Well, one thing I would like to kind of add to that is one of the things I'm involved in right now is a litigation of one label auditing another label, and that is not fun. It's a long process.
It's expensive.
It's very expensive. It's excruciating. There's a lot of fighting. There's a lot of bad blood, and nobody really wants to go there, but you're absolutely right as far as you really do kind of have to take your record label's word on it.
And just, I know there's another question, but just to respond to the home taping situation, I have a series of quotes here. John Philip Sousa, 1909, says, "The phonograph is killing music." In 1980, the British phonographic industry, "Home taping is killing music." In 2004, International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, "Piracy is killing music." So apparently music has been dying for 100 years. But regardless of that, in 1982, the Copyright Royalty Tribunal concluded that home tapers purchased the most amount of music. That was their audience. The people who were saying, "You're destroying music, you're killing music," those are the people buying records. Whether that's happening now, I know during, in 2001, during the Napster trial, the guy went up and says, "Okay, all this file sharing has been going on since 1999. In the first half of the year, 2001, CD sales were up 8%. Despite the $19 price tag, people were still buying CDs. And what he was saying is correct in that CD sales have been going down. In the recent issue of Billboard that Suffocation was in, so I bought a copy, I was reading the charts and it said CD sales down 14% from the same period of time last year. Digital sales, legitimate digital sales, up 14% from the same period last year.
And but one of the issues with that too, and that chart actually included the digital sales. Digital sales themselves have gone up. But part of it is, if you think about it, a lot more people are buying one song instead of buying the entire album. So you can't get away with just putting a lot of junk on the end of the album and foisting it off on the consumer.
Yeah, the revenues might be down, but people are still buying the music.
That's.
You had your hand up.
I guess Mike.
Okay.
So I had a question about what Rhea is looking for. So it sounded like in the second trial, the judge left it up to the jury as a matter of fact whether putting the music out there is infringing. So even if that
decision is held on appeal, if it was a matter of fact-finding by the jury, does it really have any sort of standing with respect to any other case?
Well, I personally don't think that that was a proper thing to give to a jury, because I think that is an issue of law. But so I suspect the appeals court will make some kind of a decision on that, assuming it goes to appeal, which I'm sure it will. And I would tend to think that that's not, like I said, not what a jury should be deciding. But yeah, if it was a matter of fact, then it wouldn't have any bearing on anything, really.
Also, it's not just, file sharing is not just not allowed by the consumers, but believe it or not, the artists themselves do not have the right. If they're on a record label, there's been cases, both the Beastie Boys and Tom Petty, of all people, made their music available for free downloads, and their own record labels shut it down and told them they couldn't do that. So even the artists themselves, unless you release the music yourself independently without a record label or get your label's permission, you don't have the right to release your music for free.
Right, and the reasoning behind that is that typically those advances I was referring to earlier, the artist comes to the record label, says, I want to put out an album, give me some money. So the record label will give them some money, and in return, they assign all their rights to the sound recording, the actual physical recording that occurred into the studio.
The artist still has the publishing rights.
Right.
The artist, if they're shared with a publisher, but yeah, the physical mechanicals?
Yeah, the mechanical, the songwriter, and typically the publishing, unless they split with a record label, which is also common. But there's CDs, or music in general, there are a lot of layered rights. And that's a lot of, you know, as far as contracting goes with the musicians, between the musicians and the labels, there's a lot of discussion on who gets which rights. And the smaller name artists usually lose most everything when they sign to a label. It's kind of painful. And that's one thing that, one good thing that does come out of this from an artist standpoint is because of the internet downloading, because there's a lot of things you can do now that you couldn't do 20 years ago, an artist has a much better shot of running on their own and saying, I don't need a label because I want to release my own music. I don't want them making all the money off of it if it's successful.
Which I was going to actually talk about, but this gentleman has been waiting.
Yeah, actually, I have so many questions, but I'm going to bring it down to a two-parter. One, in college, I'd take a lot of sort of undergrad kind of media law stuff, and I took a class from Joe Beck. I'm sure you're familiar with him. As he put it, the fundamental difference between downloading music and making a copy of a CD onto a tape from a copyright perspective is that when you purchase music, you are, in fact, buying a license for personal use. And if you, for instance, have a CD player in your home but a tape player in your car, it's legal for you to make a copy of that to use in your car because you bought the rights to listen to the song at your leisure.
Yes, and you'd have the more technical answer, but I actually just read on this. There's a new book that just came out called Ripped about the digital downloading. It's a really good book. But technically, you don't have the right to that, but they won't sue you because there's a Latin phrase which essentially translates to don't sweat the small stuff, where they're not going to go after you for that. But technically, you don't have the right.
De minimis, I think, is what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. It's a de minimis infraction. But yeah, it really depends on how the rights are set up. And that's what's funny. There's no contract whenever you buy a CD. But that's what's, in fact, happening. You're correct. And so it just kind of depends.
But you don't have, like, an in-situ ownership of that music.
Only of the
disc, but right. Not of the music.
Right, you don't own the... Exactly. So you really should not transfer from one media to another. Now, I think that's kind of ridiculous. But that's the way the law treats it.
And then the other question for you in particular, sir, is... as someone who deals with and represents independent artists, my band, our policy is that all of our music is available for free.
Oh, absolutely.
On the internet. And I just want to know, are there other people out there doing that?
Yes, like, that's what... Are you familiar with the Creative Commons license?
Not in detail, but I know of it.
Okay. Seeing as this is a science fiction convention, I'll invoke Jonathan Colton, who made the song Code Monkey and Re Your Brains. And he's from Brooklyn, from New York. And he put out his music, as well as Nine Inch Nails did this, under the Creative Commons license. What that means is there's a bunch of different variations on it, but it essentially allows other people to use it in non-commercial formats without asking permission. I'm sure many of you have gone on YouTube and you click on a video and there's a little thing at the bottom that says the sound has been taken off because it used licensed music. Meaning, even for a non-commercial purpose, if you use your favorite track for a YouTube video, you're not allowed to. because of the licensing. With the with a Creative Commons license, they are essentially giving you the right without having to ask individually. So what happened with Jonathan Coulton is these really clever animators took some World of Warcraft machinima and created music videos for his music without asking his permission, put it up on YouTube, and got millions and millions of views, allowing the artist to sell so many iTunes tracks that he was able to quit his job as a computer programmer and just do his music full time. So, yes, there is absolutely validity in giving your music away for free, but it's the artist's choice. You choose to do that, not the consumer, to buy your music and then say, well, screw you, I'm going to make it available for free. You as the artist are saying, we're going to, and giving it away for free is absolutely a very valid marketing choice.
Well, and I would just kind of like to add in there, you know, as far as putting it out there for free, I honestly feel like for a small artist, your biggest enemy is anonymity. So anything you can do out there to promote and get yourself out there, it's worth doing. So,
yeah, you're making the choice to do that, and it's absolutely a valid choice. But other independent artists, like, again, those who are starting to get sales and who, you know, again, Voltaire, he openly speaks out against people just downloading his music without paying them, because you get to a certain point, it's like, you know, it's like, okay, I quit my job. I do this music for full time. And it's like they feel that they should be making a living off it, you know, if they're popular enough. I mean, obviously, if you're still playing in a garage and you're not at that point yet. And I know a lot of people will diss the record labels, and I'll diss the record labels, and I'll say bad things about them, or the Nuclear Blast Rocks. They do invest in the artist. They are lending you money in the form of the advance, knowing that, again, 75% of the times, they're not getting that money back if you don't sell enough records to recoup their investment. They also, because I hear a lot of people who support online piracy and say, well, I will download a song for free, and if I like the band, I'll buy a t-shirt and I'll see him in concert. Well, that's great. The record label doesn't get any of that, and the record label still invested to make that artist possible for you to know about, and you were basically cutting the label out of the loop. If you want to cut the label out of the loop, then that's great. Then we need to come up with a new system on how to discover new music, because the record labels are buying the advertising, they're doing the radio promotion, they're doing the video promotion, and if you want to completely get rid of labels, that's a legitimate argument. What's going to replace it? Because not everyone is Nine Inch Nails. Not everyone is Radiohead doing the online downloads. Not those are bands who are, Prince did it, but they're already established artists who are banking on their own success and popularity under the record label system to then go out and do it independently without saying, screw it, we don't need the record labels. I mean, Trent Reznor was counting the days till he was done with his Universal deal so he can release his own music under the Creative Commons license, allowing people to remix his music, and he hosted a remix contest. So that's great if you're Trent Reznor, but if you're an independent artist with, you know, 500 friends on MySpace, it's like you still need something that'll give you that exposure. And right now, unfortunately, for better or for worse, the record label system is what's doing it.
I have a couple of questions. I'll just ask both of them and let you address them.
Okay.
Has there been any verification of CBS providing auto-scrobbling information to RIAA? And if they did, why would they do that? It was broken on the internet, I guess, in February. And of course, CBS owned, or still owns, I guess, Last.fm. Last.fm said they didn't know anything about it. CBS denies that it occurred. This internet source said that it was an employee that told them and gave them the email and so forth. What could they do with this auto-scrobbling data, first of all? And I guess I'm immediately concerned when I am scrobbling something and it comes up without an identifier. I think, is that what they're looking for, to see if, you know, that came from a bad place? And second, what's the industry's interest in MP3 bloggers? I mean, for independent artists, they're absolutely necessary. Is anybody looking at those? Is that something that your clients would be concerned with, or you just kind of let them go? Or,
well,
anyway.
And I guess from my standpoint, most of my clients are in the gospel market, so they're really just moving into more of the digital stuff because most of their audience are older. And those are the kinds of things we're looking into. I'm not familiar with the term scrabbling, did you say?
Scrabbling.
Okay, that's something I haven't actually looked up. But I mean, even for the smaller labels, anything that gets exposure out there is a good thing, just so long as you know, you're not giving away the farm. And that's usually the attitude with smaller labels and smaller artists. Although I don't know that answers your question.
Yeah, I, unfortunately, same thing. I'm a bit baffled as to the first half of the question as well. I'm not familiar with that.
Well, audio scrobbling is basically a programming method where it's a program that allows a server basically to record in real time what people are listening to. Last FM has about 25 million subscribers right now. And if you're logged in to Last FM while you're listening to something on your computer, or later when you sync your iPhone or your iPod, it will record the music that you've listened to.
Well, then the answer would be an online performing rights organization. Right. Are you familiar with how the PROs work with radio and ASCAP, BMI, CSAC? They basically, if you're a venue owner and you have cover bands, or if you have a jukebox, or you do anything where you are performing other people's music, instead of paying each individual artist, you pay a fee to ASCAP, BMI, and or CSAC, not so much CSAC, and then they have some ridiculously complicated formula, which then divvies the monies out against, with suffocation. We're on ASCAP, so we get every now and again a pittance check from ASCAP. So with that kind of technology, you would be able to do the same thing with online radio. Get a sampling of what artists are being listened to, so that in essence, an online performance rights organization would be able to. And I know there's been a big thing with Last FM and Live 365 and everything like that, where the performance rights organizations are trying to charge them, and supposedly they're actually trying to charge them more than what terrestrial radio is right. getting charged, which is ridiculous because their profit model is completely different.
Yeah, because you're finding music and then you have the opportunity to buy it.
Yeah.
You know, from iTunes or
whatever.
Well,
I mean, if you just listen to internet radio without making the purchase, yes, it is acting as exposure, but again, like radio, there is a model in place for artists to get compensated from that playing, because it's different than buying a CD. So I wasn't aware of that, but that sounds kind of like why they would try to get that kind of information. I did a lot of research for this, but the talking about distribution and music, basically the reason why I'm here on this panel is because something happened to us a few months ago. A fan made a video of a Suffocation song, and the average Suffocation official video from like Relapse or previous label gets about 400,000 views on YouTube. This fan video of just a guy in a shirt and a tie drumming in his office, lip syncing to Pierce From Within, generated over 3.5 million views and was free publicity for us. The guy even came to one of the band's shows, met with the band. The band was like, yeah, it's great, no problem. The parent label, that they were on Roadrunner at one point, the parent of Roadrunner is Warner Music. Warner Music has interns and bots scouring YouTube looking for licensed music being used illegally, and the video was pulled from YouTube without our knowledge, consent, or permission. We freaked out. My boss, the band's manager, calling everyone, and because the guy is now blogging on his blog going, I thought they liked it. What's going on? And now I'm perceiving a massive PR shitstorm. And because metal fans are extremely, if they think you're being messed with, they're going to really go at you. So we eventually got a backup and everything. But it's like, like I was saying before with Tom Petty, and the label will do things without consulting the artist because they feel they own the rights to the music. And our thinking is, it's free publicity. People are listening to this, not knowing who Suffocation is, and going, this is a really cool video. And I have no stats to say that this resulted in any sales, but if that thing sold one CD of those 3.5 million views, if one guy bought a CD from that, it was worth it. So that kind of opened my eyes, and because I'm a big fan. I love fan videos. I think every artist should encourage fan videos of their music. And the last thing I want to say, and then we'll just open up for questions, is we're talking about stats. I actually found the stats. For the first half of 2009, CDs made up 65% of all music sales. This is all legitimate sales, not illegal downloading. I don't have those stats. 25% of all music sales was iTunes. Now you think about the internet and the promise of the internet and everything going, it'll decentralize everything because right now there's four major record labels controlling all of music. Well, congratulations. Now there's one company controlling all of music and it's called iTunes. The number two digital distribution was Amazon at 8%. The number two overall distributor of all music, Walmart. So instead of decentralizing everything, it is now centralizing everything, where now Steve Jobs, in a few years, could potentially control all the music that is listened to. And then by the end of 2010, digital music sales are expected to equal CD sales. So CDs are essentially being shown the door.
Well, one thing that we need to watch as well is there are some potential antitrust issues there, because if you've got, you know, Steve Jobs drops the price of a song on iTunes to $1, runs all the other competition out, then jacks it up to $6 a song, then what do you do? Where do you go to get your music? So that's certainly something to be concerned about.
I mean, it's pretty much the same thing that happened. One of my banner dates is 1996, the Telecommunications Act, which lifted the restrictions on corporate ownership of radio stations. And then Clear Channel went on a bit of a monopoly buying spree, buying up 247 of the top 250 radio markets in the country. Then they bought SFX, creating the largest concert touring organization. So again, one company controlling radio and controlling live music. You know, and then in 1999, Seagram consolidates the record labels and purchases Universal. So a soft drink company is now creating the largest music company in the world, the Universal Music Group. And then 2001, the Napster decision, where 3 years before iTunes was launched, the record labels could have had an online presence ready to go through an established company making $150 million a year in a non-exclusive distribution deal. Before they were offered that deal, all the record labels combined had sold a total of 1,000 tracks legally through their websites. So, there's that. Questions?
With the advance of digital music, how do you feel that DRM is going to be affecting this, the file formats, sharing, getting your music off your disc on your
computer? You mean the security measures?
Yeah.
What I've read, and you might know more about this, is that they're kind of, they might be phasing that out. One of the proposed deals being put on the table is an ISP licensing fee, where the record labels will charge internet service providers a licensing fee, similar to the ASCAP BMI fees that venues pay, where AOL and Yahoo and internet service providers will actually pay a licensing fee, which would then get passed on to the consumer at maybe like $5 a month or whatever, for unlimited music downloading, and basically circumventing the whole thing, where you won't have a choice. You will pay for music downloading and you will have access to unlimited music downloading, and that's it. Take out the piracy, take out everything. Whether this is actually going to happen, I have no idea, but it's one of the things being proposed and would eliminate the need for any of that kind of security, because then people can just download music as much as they want. The labels are getting their money. Presumably the artists will eventually get their money. And when the labels do their little math, labels are good at math. So I don't know if you might know about the DRM stuff.
I mean that's kind of what I had heard, is that it's they're lightening up on that a lot, because record companies, at the end of the day, they don't want to piss you off, they just want your money. So anything that's going to, you know, aggravate you, they're not going to push it.
Sony realized they screwed up.
Yeah.
Is basically how it is. They got if the RIAA, they act as a buffer to the record labels, because they don't sell anything. There's no, you don't go buy a CD and say, oh, this is an RIAA product, screw that, I'm not going to buy it. The record labels have a little bit more of a branding issue. than our age. So they can be the bad guys. The labels have to be kind of the good guys. So Sony realized they screwed up, because a lot of the game manufacturers that use a lot of this, when, you know, if you have a laptop, you buy another computer, and you can't reinstall the game that you legally bought because of that stupid security. So I believe that's something they are lightening up on. They're looking at alternatives. They're finding out that restrictions and security and lawsuits isn't working. It's not getting rid of the problem. They're trying to come up with a whole new method, a whole another revenue model to get the money for the music and get the music to the people.
Yes, sir?
It sounds like the thing where the ISPs all pay the recording industry. That sounds like the Canadian system where all blank media has a tariff attached to it. Which, I mean, think about that. What a weird situation that could bring about. The RIAA is really worried that they're going to disappear because they're no longer necessary. I buy music from people who don't have a label, you know, not all the time, but the RIAA could evaporate as an entity and just make all this money from doing nothing, you know? If there's no need to have a label anymore, if there's no need for that, and they're gone, then what service do they provide? And what you wind up with is this entity that does nothing, and we all put money in a pot and they get it. For what?
Well, I mean, it's the kind of thing where, unfortunately, the legal and corporate structures move much slower than the technology. Like we were saying before, that it took 20 years for them to acknowledge that CDs exist. It's just something that there was a purpose for it, and some would argue there's still a purpose of the RIAA, but because things are moving so quickly, a lot of people are banding about, well, let's just do away with record labels. But you figure, I mean, this is, record labels are an extremely established part of music. You have four or five conglomerates still, again, who will put out music? How will bands be financed? They do need those advances, and you know, it's like, are they gonna, you know, I mean, a lot of independent bands, they work part-time and do their music and they manage to put out a good product, but for the most part, you get the advance, you live off it, you record the CD with it, and then you put the record out. So it's like, get rid of the labels. Okay, that again, I said before, it's a legitimate argument. What's going to replace it? What's going to be the new model that would allow for music to come out?
It seems like people can do it. You know, there's a band called Happy Birthday Amy that I listen to. That just, they don't have a label. They don't do any app. They have a website. You can buy their CD on their website. If you know the band is called Happy Birthday Amy, you just look that up on Google, go to their website. You can buy their CD.
How'd you find out about them?
What? I think I heard about them on a website that distributes free music, actually.
Oh, there you go. So that could be the new radio, would be stuff like Live 365, but you still have the same issues with radio, and even if it's free, even if it's online radio, of picking playlists that they think people are going to want to hear, and how much do you balance out well-known artists. I ran a nightclub for 2 years, and it was still like, when we wanted to introduce a new song, we usually had to sandwich it in between two well-known songs. And even then, it may not always, you're still going to have the same problems. And even if you remove a lot of the, with commercial radio, obviously they have to exist in a top 40 mentality because they're advertiser driven and they need to generate listeners in order to get the advertising dollars. In order to generate listeners, they need to play music they know people will want to listen to.
Well, actually, I'd like to add in two things that occurred to me when you were asking the question. One thing you mentioned, Canada, where there's a tariff on re-recordable disc and such. What you have to realize is there's one here too. That's what that AARC I was talking about earlier, ARC, they, every time that you buy a blank CD, their money from that goes into ARC and is distributed to record labels and artists, big name artists that sign up for this. So this is one of the income streams they get. So that does happen, you just don't know about it. And the thing is too, one thing RIAA does do, I mean groups like RIAA, and I think will continue to be necessary whether it's them or somebody else doing it, is there, you have to have some technical standards to make the music work. And that's like, you know, if you buy a CD at Walmart, you know, if you go home and stick in your CD player, it's going to play. If you don't have some kind of a standards body, at least, then there's always that concern that there will be technical issues that are just going to throw a monkey wrench in the whole thing. So whether that needs to be RIAA or anybody else, that's certainly open for debate.
What about open standards? There's open standards out there.
There are, but the problem with standards that are too open is they kind of tend to morph over time. But
they all do. Well, they all do. All the standards morph over time. CD came after this, came after this. I mean, who cares? If you're smart enough, you can figure it out. You can put out a podcast for the price of a laptop. You know, and everybody who already has a laptop, they could do one right now for nothing.
Right, and then you have, I remember reading many years ago in Billboard, Sheryl Crow was talking about how great the internet was in that it levels the playing field and allows all these independent artists through podcasting, through MySpace, through YouTube, through all these different things to have their music out there. But then you have the problem of too much content. And again, how do certain acts rise above? How do certain artists, and again, the record label system, for better or for worse, and I'm not going to sit here and say they're awesome, but for better or for worse, it did create a system where certain artists became popular and independent artists of specific genres. So if you're into industrial music, or if you're into punk, or if you're into goth or country, you knew there were certain record labels and places you can go for that, but it still created, and then there are just certain independent bands that are independent because they're just freaking awful. You know, it's like sometimes having access to more music is not always a good thing, because I worked for a magazine. I've had a lot of jobs, apparently. I worked for a magazine for 10 years doing CD reviews, and a lot of independent bands are bad. They're just bad, and they don't deserve to get successful or whatever. And a lot of popular bands are bad, but people buy it. So whatever, who am I to say? But it's sometimes equal time for all artists is not always a good thing. Sometimes some system, whether it be record labels, whether it be websites, whether it be YouTube, some system will evolve naturally somehow that will rise certain artists up and keep certain artists down in the obscurity that they so richly deserve.
Sort of restating a bit of what you just said is that the democratization of media, the affordable computer technology has been promising us for the last 15 years happened, and most of what came out of it sucked.
Yeah.
And I'm probably making myself a lot of enemies in the room here by saying this, but the truth, and whether you're talking about people, you know, blogs instead of books, or movies people made in their backyard instead of studio pictures, or stuff people, you know, record in their bathroom instead of going to a studio, there is a technical expertise, there is training and money that goes into the way a lot of, you know, the established method of producing content.
Home recording is a perfect example of that.
It doesn't sound good.
It's what a lot of people skip with home recording is, you can get at Sam Asher Guitar Center or your local music store the software and the equipment relatively inexpensive. What you can't pick up is a qualified engineer and producer. And those are the people that make the CDs sound good, not the equipment. And it's still worthwhile going to a professional recording studio, getting a real engineer, and finding a producer who knows what they're doing, and to make your music sound as good as it can possibly be. It's a lot of people skip that element. It's like, you know, it's like if we can just get heard by the right people, it's like, well, there's a lot more to it. And again, those are all the things that add to the cost of the CD. You know, the artist getting their 9%, the producer getting his 3%, the studio getting paid. And it's like these are all necessary things, because when you listen to these, someone, and I've heard them, I get them sent to me all the time, and these people, you know, like we've all watched the first two episodes of American Idol, and they're like, don't these people have friends that tell them that they can't sing? You know, it's like, well, how did they get to, it's like, I get these bands, they send me these CDs, and it's like, review us. You won't like what I'd have to write. I won't write a bad review of an independent band. Bjork, I'll trash. But I won't write a bad review of an independent artist. So if I don't like it, I just won't review it. But these bands, they'll call and they'll call and they'll call and they say, please review us. And it's like, dude, you won't like it. You won't like what I have to say. I will put as positive a spin on it as possible. But it's like, get a producer, get an engineer. And yes, it's expensive. You know, and yeah, sometimes, you know, you get these sleazy producers offering spec deals and saying, you know, I'll record your project for free in exchange for points on the back end. And if your project doesn't go anywhere, you didn't lose anything. But then you get Aerosmith, who are selling millions and millions of records in their first contract and not seeing a dime because they signed away so many of their rights. So it's a constant give and take. But I mean, I guess I am agreeing with you in that it's not enough. There still has to be that spark of quality, and there still has to be some sort of filtering process that if you are just given access to every piece of music ever recorded in the world equally, you're not going to listen to anything because you're not going to be able to find what you're looking for.
I mean, it seems like social networking has solved that problem. You now have the access to millions of people around the world who collectively provide a distributed filter, and things do rise to the top. You know, somebody's internet video gets 40 million views, and
absolutely,
most people's internet videos get 10 views, and that's the result of a process that's a distributed process.
That is starting to happen.
That'll happen with music. Just I really find the argument that we need to prop up the record companies because they're going to be tastemakers to be absurd. Now, the idea that we need an economic system that's somehow going to get enough money to some people so that they can afford to hire a producer and they can afford to have a quiet room and they can, you know, if we're going to have a certain level of quality in some of the stuff that's produced, then we need a way to make that happen. But I don't need to pay somebody to tell me what to listen to.
Well, and the great thing about that, too, is that, yeah, and this is something that kind of occurred to me while you were talking. People don't get famous by being discovered, realistically. It takes a lot of work, a lot of effort, and some money on the front end. So, you know, and that's the great thing about those social networking sites is that if you get out there and you use those and you, you know, really push your music and you make a lot of friends, get thousands of friends on Facebook and MySpace, you know, that hard work, you can actually get somewhere with it where you might not have been able to pre-internet days.
Well, but then the downside of
does anyone have to be famous? I mean, you're assuming that we somehow need that the model of music needs to be this kind of Ziffian distribution where there's a few people who make $100 million and another few people who make tens of millions and somewhat fewer make a few, and then, you know, and then Joe in his garage, 99 million people in their garage make a dollar. It doesn't have to be. It will be whatever emerges.
Well, but again, the point of musicians, at the very least, a working band, their general goal is, and again, this is part of what I do as consulting, is they want to, at the very least, make a living doing what they're enjoying. If an artist just wants to make music for the pure enjoyment of making art and giving it away for free, then that's fine, obviously. But the moment they want to make a living doing it, there has to be an introduction of a business element of some sort, you know. And the moment they want to play in a club and you got to pay a cover, then that's a business. The moment you make a CD and are charging for it, it's a business. It means looking at your music, which a lot of musicians have a hard time doing. And in a way, why I kind of respect rap music more than rock music, because rock musicians are very hung up on the art and the image and the don't want to be sellouts. Rappers are, where do I sign? You know, I just want, you know, and it's like, I kind of respect that honesty of, is that they're still looking at it as art, and they're still looking at it as I'm making art, but it's like, they want to get paid, and they want to make a living doing this, and it's not just about making millions and millions of dollars, because honestly, they're not. Even if you go, I remember hearing a statistic that even if you go gold, 500,000 units, each band member is only going to make about $16,000 from record sales. You know, so you're not making, it's not millions and millions of dollars, it is, you know, there is making thousandaires of these people. It is only through the touring and the licensing and the merchandising and all of that stuff that they really start to. And I said before, 75% of new signings to a label don't make money. 90% don't recoup their advance. It is out of 30,000 CDs released in an average year, 186 of them will profit. Really profit, really make a lot of money. So there is a filtering process going on. Independent labels, I think, are great for that, because what their independent labels are doing is the job of artist development that the major labels don't want to do anymore. There's no more Black Sabbaths, there's no more Led Zeppelins, no more bands that take two or three albums to get their act together. If you're not a hit in album one, they're dropping you. So what an independent label will do is, if you sell 60,000 records units on an independent label, they take you out to dinner. You sell 60,000 on a major label, they take you in the backyard and kill you. So what an independent label can do is develop an artist and put them out for 2, 3, 4 albums and get them ready for major label distribution. You know, if that's going to be the future, you know, again, that's how it is right now. Obviously, things may change, but I mean, again, right now we can only work with what's existing. We can speculate about, you know, what's going to happen in the future and like what's going to take the place of these things. And as far as A&R people are not tastemakers, A&R records are taste predictors. It takes 6 to 12 months from signing to album release. So an A&R guy isn't trying to tell you what's going to be popular. He's trying to predict what the hell's going to be popular a year from now and sign them now. When Slipknot got signed, I have a personal investment in this because I'm friends with Bile, a New York industrial band. Roadrunner literally were Bile, Slipknot, Bile, Slipknot, Bile, Slipknot. And they signed Slipknot. So now every time I see Slipknot on TV, I'm like, that could have been Bile. After they got signed, after they got really popular, every other record label starts signing their own version of Slipknot. Mushroomhead, Mudvayne, all these bands start coming out with the masks and the styles and everything like that. And they're like, oh, they're just ripping off, ripping off Slipknot. But most of those bands were around the same time, if not earlier, than Slipknot. They just got signed later. To the public eye, they didn't exist until they were on a label and putting out records. You know, you forget about the 2 or 3 crap albums that White Zombie had before they get popular. You know, so there's a lot of things that the average consumers are not seeing, that nothing exists until it's right in front of them. And they're not trying to be tastemakers. They're not trying to force their opinions on you. They're desperately trying to figure out what you like, and they're trying to get it to you in a year in advance. And that's why a lot of bands get dropped, because that year, a lot of things change, and what was popular at one point is now dead, and they just say, well, I'm sorry, and they don't even put out an album. They just drop the band.
Yeah, like the Beatles. They played for years in dives all over the place before anybody ever heard of them.
Yeah. It's you're never going to have a label signing a band and giving them 3 or 4 records to find themselves and develop themselves. It is hit from day one or else.
Well, and incidentally, too, the labels now are requiring, I mean, because they're panicking, they've had these sales problems, they're really requiring a lot more out of these artists, you know, before they even sign them. Like, you know, how many albums have you sold of the previous junk that you put together in your bathtub? You know, how much money can you make for me before I even invest a dime in you?
How many plays do you have on MySpace? Yes. MySpace plays is becoming the new SoundScan. Mm-hmm. It is the way because you can have 1 million friends just because you're aggressive on MySpacing. But if no one's listening to the music, then that doesn't mean anything. But if you're getting 1,000 plays a day, then they'll take notice. So that is your new statistic that you can use. If you're not selling a lot of records and you're not packing them into the venues, but you're getting a lot of MySpace plays, that could be an indication to a label that you might sell a lot of CDs. And again, it's like we demonize the record labels. And again, I do it. I make fun of them all the time. But ultimately, they're just trying to figure out what's going to sell CDs. They're not sitting there looking at Jonas Brothers and saying, we're going to foist this crap upon the American public and twist their mustaches. They're like, hey, the kids seem to like this crap. Let's put out an album. You know, it's like, if you don't want bad music to be put out by the record labels, stop buying it. That's the only advice I can give. It's as long as people keep buying those artists, then they'll encourage the record labels to keep putting them out.
All right, do we have any other questions?
I see new people coming in. Are we approaching our time limit?
I guess.
All
right. I think we have about 15 more minutes, Scott.
15 minutes.
Oh, wow. I can't sing. let me see if I went over all my notes. I guess, let me ask. How many of you would be, because a lot of people, when I was reading up on the ISP licensing fee, a lot of people were like, tax, it's a tax. And it's a fee. There's a difference between a tax and a fee. For one thing, the government's not doing it. It is a fee to compensate record labels and artists and copyright holders for digital music being downloaded. And if they can't physically stop the people from downloading the music illegally, then just screw it. Then we'll just make it all available, and you'll get charged the back end. There's a person in the back end. Then
I just wanted to add something about what he was saying about the standards and not needing a
governing body of some sort to come up with the technical specifications for playback. I know I've worked a lot of helpless jobs. I have a 50-year-old mother who can be taught things, but if they get too complex or if it just doesn't work, she's done.
Yeah.
You know, I can't remember if it's the red standard or the yellow book standard, but audio CDs been standardized in the 1970s and haven't been changed since. MP3s were standardized two decades ago and haven't been changed since. We've tacked on things to it, which can make some MP3s screw up in some systems that I've seen. But there is a need for somebody to put their foot down at some point and go, this is how this is going to have to work. Everybody else just needs to run with this. Because otherwise, things get muddled. I have trouble getting Og Vorgas to work on my system half the time because they keep updating it. They keep tweaking it. And if I have to go download the new codec every couple of months because this particular one I downloaded doesn't want to play nice. The average consumer is not going to deal with that. I can deal with it because it's no big deal for me. My mother... No, she's not. She'll call me up and go, what the heck is wrong with this stupid thing?
I mean, it's having, I know with the standards of sound, one of the things we encourage independent artists is to, if you are going to make a CD, especially if you're going to be sending it out to press and to record labels, is to get it professionally replicated. Don't CD burn it, because it's not 100% going to play on all systems. And the worst thing in the world is to actually get an A&R person to listen to your music, have them pop it into their player, and it not work. You know, it has to work at that point. I've heard that story so many times of, Andy Karp used to write for my magazine. He was promoted to head of A&R for Atlantic Records. And he was a very frank, to the point kind of guy. And he's like, I listen to bad music all the time, and I get these artists who are sending me these CDs that don't work. And it's like, you know, he's a busy guy, and he listens to the CD, and it's not going to work. He will never consider that artist again. So there has to be, you know, so you get it professionally replicated. It's, you know, like I said, it's a buck a unit, so it's not like you're investing the farm. And it doesn't have to look nice. They're not going to look at the packaging, but it's got to sound good. So
what you were saying about a fee paid to ISPs for unlimited downloading.
From ISPs.
Well, but the fee would be passed on to the consumer.
Almost, definitely.
Yes.
That strikes me as an avenue by which the RIAA or some other analogous organization could push out independent producers, because if everyone's getting their music through downloads and all of the music coming through the ISPs is provided through whatever mechanism they set up for these fees, well, then the independent producers might lose access through that system. Does that make sense?
Well, I guess it depends, too, on if that system is mandated by the government as opposed to something that private parties contract with. If it's mandated by the government, it's a little bit harder to push people out. If it's a private contract, it's a lot more likely to happen. But even when it's mandated, you know, if you're a smaller time person, A, is there enough money in it to make it worth you figuring out how to do it so you can get that money? And B, do you even know it exists? And that's part of what you have to look at, you know, if you're in the music business, if you're, you know, whether you're running a label or running a band, you need to know what kinds of things are out there that you might be able to get your hands into to be able to make a living and keep going. Kind of like that art thing.
Unfortunately, there's not enough information on how it would work in order to answer your question. I know with iTunes, usually... I mean, all the major record labels license directly with iTunes for a non-exclusive distribution deal. If you're an independent band, you can get your music on iTunes through a third party, a middleman called an iTunes aggregator, who basically collects a whole bunch of independent labels and acts and whatnot, and then presents it to iTunes under one licensing deal. I will make a little warning about that. Again, you said you're a musician. I'm sure there's other people here who are musicians. That if you get involved in a distribution deal, even if it's online only, such as the third-party aggregator or a internet label that will agree to pay you a greater percent, like 70% or 50% as opposed to 9 to 12%, which is what most bands get, that's great and all, unless you are offered a deal by a real record label, because I'm sure you'll back me up with this, no legitimate record label will offer you a deal if you have any distribution deal set up with another company, even if that other deal is non-exclusive, because the record label will want exclusive. And if you're, well, I'm already being set up with the other company, they're gonna, well, you're gonna have to cancel it, which could take up to a year to for the cancellation to come through.
Well, and just kind of add on that too, it's not just a money issue. From the record company standpoint, it's an accounting and paperwork nightmare. If you come in and you have some kind of weird deal that doesn't fit into their system, you know, they're hiring lower level people to handle all this stuff, and they don't want you throwing their whole system into chaos.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are all concerns.
But I mean, as far as what you're asking, again, there's no specific logistical. It is more like, well, what about this? Basically, the general idea is all the ISPs agree to pay this licensing fee to the record labels to make all music available for online downloads. I don't see why an independent artist or an independent label, not part of the big four system, wouldn't be able to throw their hat into the ring. They may not make a lot of money that way, but at least their music would be available equally with the other people. Because again, what we were talking about before with online, and you're talking about the CBS thing, is that it's easier to track what's being downloaded, much easier than trying to track radio station airplay. For divvying up, like the Napster deal, the 2001 Napster deal, that was pretty much what this was. We make all the music available for download, and but there was a monthly fee, so it was a subscription service. But as far as how the money would be divvied up, it would be by band rate. However much, so if Universal Music Group was getting 75% of the downloads, they would get a higher percentage of that $150 million a year. And if Sony was only getting 10% or whatever, it would be broken up that way. It's much easier to track downloads than it is even CD sales, because you have mom and pops that aren't always hooked into SoundScan as effectively. And you know, so with CD sales, things fall through the cracks, which is why the labels like them, because then they can withhold your payments. With downloads, it's a little more organized and a little more trackable, so you can see, well, Britney Spears got this many downloads, and Metallica got this many, and then Band A from Podunk got, you know, got 0.0005% of the downloads. So it's very easily trackable, but I don't see a system like that in and of itself forcing out the little guy, because it would be wanting access to new music that would make this workable. But we'll see. I have no idea.
Yeah, there you go.
I just wanted to ask a couple of questions about this ISP-based fee system. Do they plan to make it something that you just pay regardless of whether you use it or not?
Yep.
And what if I don't download any music whatsoever?
Tough. That's all. I mean, it is a fee to cover everyone, whether you individually download. You will have access to download music. Whether you actually do it or not is irrelevant. You will have the ability
market
to do
economics
it.
Dictate that people won't stand for that.
But again, like he said,
that
people are doing it now.
They'll invent ISPs and ways of accessing the internet that will bypass that fee.
That's the model that phone service runs on.
You know, it's unfortunate, and like you were saying before, when you buy blank media, you're paying that fee.
And most people don't know that. So if the market doesn't realize what's going on.
It's not like you're going to get an itemized bill from your ISP. All of a sudden, you'll get a note from whoever your ISP is saying, oh, by the way, you now have access to this new feature. And then a couple months later, you'll notice, why did my bill go up?
Well, to some extent, the customer base has already agreed to just that kind of feature now, because how many of you actually use every byte of your bandwidth every month that you're paying for?
Mm-hmm.
You paid for it. You paid for it. You try. Yeah, you're single-handedly pirating all the music. Yeah.
Same with everything. Skype. Anything you're not using, you're still paying.
Yeah.
Why that?
I mean, you have features on your computer you don't use. You have features on your car you don't always use. I have buttons on my car. I don't even know what they do. You know, it is, but it's just something that for us now, talking about it, it's like, oh my God, they're throwing all this stuff at us. But let's say it happens next year, 2010. and presumably the world doesn't end in 2012, 10 years from now, it'll just be an accepted whatever. It'll just be part of the we'll have a little growing pains dealing with it because we existed in the pre-times, but eventually, if that becomes the universal standard, it'll be the universal standard.
Well, real quick, we're running pretty low on time, so we'll take a last question and finish it up.
Won't this basically put iTunes out of business?
God, I hope so.
You think Steve Jobs is going to stand for this? I mean,
well, contrary to his own PR, Steve Jobs does not own the internet, and he, you know,
but he's very close.
Yeah, but that's the thing. But this kind of thing would prevent, because right now, as other people have brought up, he is very close to a monopoly. You know, like I said, 25% of all music sold, period, was through iTunes. So he is pretty close to a monopoly. So something like this would circumvent that. And knowing him, he probably wouldn't fight it. He would find a way to be the guy collecting those fees from the ISPs and then getting his cut. So he's like, you know what, a million one way, a million the other way, as long as he's getting paid.
Well, thank you all for coming, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference.
Yeah.